Each decision we make is an important decision. Putting first things first in our own lives and seeing others do the same makes all the difference in quality of living. Now each author will share examples of how listening to conscience and doing the best instead of only the good helps us see the power of putting first things first.
I've come to realize the significance of this conscience. In fact, just the other day, I was being driven to the airport by a taxi driver. I got into the cab, and the hotel man said to the cab driver, "Take Dr. Covey to the Toronto International Airport." Well, this man barely spoke English, and he understood it better than he spoke it. And he thought I was a doctor. That is an MD-type doctor. I tried to explain to him. He called me doctor a couple of times. I tried to explain to him, I'm the kind of doctor that don't do nobody no good. And he didn't ever get it at all. I was a doctor to him, an MD doctor. So he started getting very open about his problems. And he began to describe all of the anxiety of his life, that he would have anxiety attacks and literally lose it from time to time. And, "Doctor, what should I do?" I didn't explain anymore. I wasn't an MD doctor. So I just started to listen to him fully, and he just opened up more and more and more. And then he began to describe his whole lifestyle, which was basically a cheating, lying lifestyle in every way. For instance, he told me how he would get another fare. He knew how to break the long line so he could get up there and get a fare in some way, if he was caught, lie himself out of it in some way and risk possibly even losing his license. But he said, "I'm so skilled at this that I can get fare after fare after fare after fare and really make a lot of money. And I've got a lot of concern about my family and I've got to take care of them." But basically, his whole life was a life of living and loving a lie, cheating in every way he possibly could. The speed limit was just one illustration, lying to people everywhere he went. So I said to him, "Since I am your doctor, I'm going to give you a little counsel. Stop lying and cheating and start following the rules." And he was so open, so teachable, he said, "Do you really think I should do that? That would help me, because this anxiety and my inability to sleep, my insomnia, everything is related to all?" I said, "Absolutely. You've got to start living with integrity." So I spent a few minutes with him and talking about how he could educate his conscience and follow his conscience. And he was like a little child just learning for the first time about a different world of meaning. "But you think I can make a living that way?" I said, "Yes, you can, and even a better one. And if you particularly improve your skills and get additional education, you don't like this job. You told me that. You could do other things. You could make more money. You could make a better living. But it'll take patience. It won't happen all at night, and you'll be tempted to fall back to old ways." I mean, I taught him for a while, and he wouldn't take the tip. He embraced me. He couldn't express enough gratitude. I don't know whatever came of that, but I am persuaded that people cannot lead a lie and maintain any sense of emotional well-being and strength. I know in my own life, if I ever falter on courage, or if I am courageous and ego-bound but falter on consideration and sensitivity, I can usually trace the fault somewhere in a lack of integrity somewhere in my life within the last few hours or perhaps few days. It'll manifest itself. I can go back there and say, "I should have done that and I didn't. I overreacted in this situation. I was unkind in this situation. I exaggerated for effect in this situation. I find where I went off course from that flight plan toward my destination, and I got feedback from my conscience." Now remember, integrity is not honesty. Honesty is one characteristic of integrity. Integrity means you are principle-centered. You are integrated around a balanced set of principles to the point that your conscience is impregnated with it. Let me tell you another experience I had on the power of conscience. At the university, I served for a number of years as the administrative assistant to the president and as director of university relations, and I was involved in doing many things where the president was to be involved. And he was a very strong person who wanted to be involved in many things, but because of the largeness and the complexity, we developed a pretty good relationship to where he would delegate many of those things to me. And one of them was dealing with the big speakers that would come to the campus. One of these men was considered the father of integrity therapy, a man who broke with the Freudian tradition, which is based upon the concept that your childhood pretty well lays out your character for a lifetime. But he was raised in that tradition and became a psychiatrist and practiced that basic tradition in his professional work. He was mostly focused upon research rather than clinical practice, and he became fascinated by researching different theories. But personally, he would go through great traumas in his life, and he learned gradually this inside-out, principle-centered, conscience-directed approach and developed the theory of integrity therapy, which basically meant that most of the emotional and mental illnesses of people don't come from an overactive superego or a very powerful social conscience as much as from disobedience to the natural conscience, which taps into the universal subconscious, which Carl Jung talked about and which I've been describing as the universal moral sense of all mankind, a sense of right and wrong. And he was one of the speakers, and I was very impressed with his speech, and he had three or four speeches he was going to give on our campus, and I was privileged to host him as we drove up the canyon one afternoon for relaxation. And so I just asked him a personal question. I said, "How did you come to this theory of integrity therapy?" And he said, "Well, I've researched it, and I've gathered so much data that I'm convinced that it is an accurate theory, not that it is the perfect one. But I am convinced that the integrity toward conscience is the key element of people's growth and happiness." He said, "But really, I came to it personally on my own. I had a very difficult emotional life. My emotions would go to heights and depths. I'm also a trained professional in the field, and I know what some of those depths could possibly involve. So when I'd reach a certain stage of depression in my emotional life, I would hospitalize myself." He said, "I was the president of one of these big psychological associations and was in the hospital and couldn't come to take the gavel of my office. And here, the whole professional work was to help people like me who was in the hospital. I hospitalized myself so that I wouldn't risk suicide. But then after a period of time, I would come out of this depression and I'd get back into a state of real awareness of what was happening and competency and responsibleness to where I could go back and do my work. So I would leave the hospital and go back to my professional work. But I found that I preferred research over work with clients because I would experience less of this emotional stress that would trigger off some of these deep bouts of depression that would last sometimes for weeks, even months. One day, I was home and I said to myself, maybe my life is wrong. Maybe that's the problem. I know I'm living a lie. Maybe I had to come clean." And he had to go through quite an internal struggle to finally commit to himself to come clean. And then he decided, "I'm going to stop living this lie, this pretending, lying existence." He said, "I had another life. I simply gave that life up. I gave up my mistress. I came clean with my wife. And I had a level of peace that I had not had for a long time." He said, "I cannot describe the nature of the peace. It was indescribable. My wife was willing to work with me and to help me, and we could continue on." And he said, "I began to think maybe the real problem is that I was in violation of my conscience, my moral sense of right and wrong, and that through this cheating and lying, I had built an elaborate rationalization system to defend myself, and that that fed into this up and down emotional life." He began using good scientific methodology to test his hypothesis, and that's how he gradually evolved his theory of integrity therapy.
I remember one time having an experience that really brought me to a startling awareness of the effects of conscience, not only on ourselves, but on the way that we look at and interact with other people. This was some years ago, and I was a young mother. I was very busy with preschool-aged children, and I was also struggling with some health problems and other concerns. At the time, I felt like I had talents, including writing, that I wanted to develop, but I just hadn't really managed my time to be able to do that. And I walked into a bookstore one day, and there on the bookshelf was a recently published book that was written by a woman I had known some years before and had considered a good friend. And at first, I was just surprised. I saw the book there, and I couldn't believe that she had actually written a book. I thought, this is wonderful. I picked it up and looked at it, and the more I thought about it, the more I thought, well, she has a very busy public life. She has a home and a family to take care of. How in the world did she find time to do it? The longer I stared at that book, the more I found myself beginning to rationalize and justify. I thought, I'm sure she must hire a babysitter to take care of the children. They must be rolling in money, and they probably eat out every night so she doesn't have to fix dinner. She's got so much energy, I'll bet she's never been sick a day in her life. There's no way she could have written that book if she had to handle all the challenges that I have. As my thoughts ran on and on, I began to think of other things that I had never had time for. And all of a sudden, it seemed like every book on that shelf seemed to jump out at me and yell, "Why haven't you read me?" Before long, I was feeling like a hopeless and incompetent, frustrated mess. I was almost angry with my perfect friend and with the people and circumstances that I thought were responsible for my own situation. I couldn't believe I was feeling this way because this was so unusual for me. I usually found a great deal of joy in the success of people that I knew. So I went out to the car and I just sat there for a few minutes thinking. I knew that this response was way out of proportion. I knew there had to be some underlying reason for the way I was feeling, so I decided to sort it all out, and I just tried to let go of all the negative and blaming and angry reactions and just really look honestly into my own heart. As I did so, I had one of those wonderful, somewhat painful, flashes of light that suddenly let you see everything for what it is. I knew I really wasn't angry with my friend. It's just that she simply had some things in her life that I didn't. And these were things that I knew I needed to have. I was seeing her accomplishments as a mirror of my own weaknesses. I knew she was a great mother. And mothering was a challenge for me, and I was seeing her tremendous patience and her positive attitude as a foil to what I felt was my own incompetence. She was able to manage her time to do meaningful and creative things outside the home. Now, I knew I had a talent for writing, too, but I simply hadn't been effective enough in my other responsibilities to find time to develop that talent. I was assuming financial ease on her part because I felt restricted by a weakness in money management. We had made some wrong decisions earlier in our marriage, and it had put us in debt. And I felt that bondage kept me from doing a lot of things that I wanted to do. I knew my friend was healthy, but that was not the problem. The problem was that I knew I ought to be exercising on a regular basis, and I wasn't doing it. Now, if I had been doing the things in my own life that I knew I ought to be doing, I never would have had those feelings in the first place. My friend's success would have been a joy to me, as it should have been. As I realized these things, I knew I couldn't snap my fingers and suddenly change all those things in my life, but at least I understood the root of the problem. I knew it was the fact that I wasn't putting first things first in my own life, and that was something I could do something about.
Several years ago, when our business was growing and just getting established, Rebecca and I had a hard decision to make that dealt with our time. There was a deep need in the business, because of the nature of the business, to spend a lot of time for me on the road in planes and going literally around the world, helping to do seminars, programs, consulting that were part of this leadership business. We knew that the need and the demand from the business was out of harmony with some of our commitments on time we were going to spend with the family and the time I was going to specifically spend at home. We'd been very careful and jealous of that time over the years, and so this appeared to be a real conflict. Well, we thought about it, we sorted it out, and came to a conscious decision that for a period of time, because of the shared mission and vision we had about this business and how it could affect us all as a family, that I would go into a period of focused imbalance. Well, we made the decision and went with it. Then the time came to start changing the mix. Changing it back was harder than I had any idea. It wasn't necessarily that I was just addicted to the traveling. In fact, I enjoy meeting people, but the traveling is not something that I get a lot out of it in that sense. There were commitments, there were expectations, there were clients and customers that I cared about. There were many things happening that were also values. And so the weeks went on, the months went on, and didn't get changed much. One day I was going through a period of review and renewal and looking at things, and I kind of had one of those in the mirror, in your face experiences. What are really first things in your life? Do you believe it or not? And I had to make a choice. We talked about it and felt I needed to set a limit. Well, we counseled about it, we thought about it, talked to some of my work associates, and came up with the number of nights that I'd be gone on a monthly basis as a limit, a maximum. And then once that was set, that became the criteria for scheduling and making decisions. And at first, people kind of tested it a little bit, you know. Boy, have you thought of this opportunity? We really need you here. And they'd push it a little bit, not in a negative way, but this was important. This was a commitment. And as soon as people sensed that it really was important, they've been very supportive. Now, that was hard. It was hard to come to the decision. It was hard to draw the line and make the commitment. But it's had great benefits, not only to our family and our personal life, but the interesting thing is it's had great benefits to the organization because I've been able to work on some things that would have been worked on when I was out on the road all the time. In fact, our very effort to create this book around First Things First really grew out of that commitment and saying, if I'm not going to be on the road, we need to work together. It's time to do this book. And it would have never happened unless I'd drawn that line. There are those times in life, turning points, where when that inner wisdom starts to say, something needs to change, you need to break through, you need to change levels, and often it's saying no to something or yes to something else, but there are those key turning points that seem to make all the difference.
To conclude this audio presentation, Stephen will give 5 suggestions on how to better make First Things First a powerful part in effective life leadership.
I would like to give 5 suggestions for follow-up so that this material is ultimately very helpful and practical to you, as well as a source of edification and inspiration. My first encouragement would be to really study this material, to get deeper into it, and to use your 4 endowments as you study this material, because you may be just being introduced for the first time. You need to think deeply. I would read, I would listen more, I would educate and cultivate your conscience and listen to it. It's not just, as you have found, a little success formula in life or a bunch of psych-up techniques that you can use to make you more successful. It is a whole life orientation. It is a life philosophy that is based upon universal, generic principles that are common to all cultures, all religions, all nationalities. That which is most personal is most general. The second thing I would encourage you to do is to get serious about developing a personal mission statement, and then a family mission statement, and then mission statements for your job, mission statements for your work group, for your department, your division, your company, your school, your classroom, your hospital, your surgical center, your governmental organization, your military unit. Whatever organization you are in, start doing leadership work. That is the work of making sure that the ladder you're climbing is leaning against the right wall. It's deciding what that right wall is. It's deciding what true north is. I suggest that you in some way put into your mission statement that you see yourself as a change catalyst to improve things, to make things better. I love the expression of George Bernard Shaw. This inspires me. It may you. This is the true joy in life, of being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, of being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances complaining that the world will not devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die. For the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. It's a sort of splendid torch which I've got to hold up for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations. I personally don't believe in retiring. I believe we should live our life in crescendo, that we should continue to make significant contributions in whole new ways all the way through our life. We may retire from a job or from an occupation, but we always retire to extremely meaningful projects. Third recommendation, I would double the time you spend in quadrant two. Study the results, and in a couple of months, double it again. Literally, most of us ignore quadrant two way too much. We need to spend more time improving our communication with people, getting feedback, learning from that feedback, doing better preparation, getting more training and education, better planning and organizing, taking better care of ourselves, our body, our mind, our spirit, seizing new opportunities, personal development, and then the summum bonum, the development of other people, and the use of their talents toward worthy purposes. Fourth recommendation, if you want to get the best start on all of this, just try to rebuild one relationship you care about which is wounded, which is deteriorating. Because what you'll find is, in the effort to improve and better and enrich that relationship, almost everything else we're talking about will automatically come into play. The key to the many is the one. Dag Hammarskjöld put it this way, it is more noble to give yourself completely to one individual than to labor diligently for the salvation of the masses. For you to build a better relationship with your boss, with that key person in the other department with whom you're carrying on an ego battle, and most importantly, of course, with your spouse and with your children, particularly when they're going through the second identity crisis called the teenage period, and the tendency is to bounce off the wall when they're doing it. To do what you need to do to build those relationships, to improve them, just one, will impact every other one. The last and final suggestion is Habit 7, sharpen the saw. Just make your mind up that you build into your quadrant 2 life on a regular basis. No one else can do this kind of work. No one. Cannot be done for you. Cannot be paid. It is work that has to be done on a daily basis. Physical, spiritual, and mental. And then the social has to do with these relationships with other people. Use a tool that drives you into quadrant two on a weekly basis, surrounding roles and goals within the context of long-term roles and goals and the overall vision and mission statement based upon principles. The social part of sharpening the saw, I suggest, involves making a difference every day in someone's life, reaching out, and whenever you deal with a difficult issue, practicing habits 4, 5, and 6, that is, thinking win-win, seeking first to understand before seeking to be understood, and going for synergistic solutions to the problems and challenges. Now remember, as with the plane that is off track 90% of the time, but yet arrives at its destination on time, all of us will be off track much of the time. But that is not the critical thing. The critical thing is that we know where we're going, and that we're resolved to get there, and that we're listening to the feedback and making the constant adaptations and adjustments to do it. I close with one of my favorite quotes. This is from Bryant S. Hinckley on the subject of service. Because ultimately, service is the rent we pay for our privilege in living in this world. And it is the essence of what a truly significant life is. But I love his words much better than my own. Listen carefully. Service is the virtue that distinguished the great of all times and which they will be remembered by. It places a mark of nobility upon its disciples. It is the dividing line which separates the two great groups of the world, those who help and those who hinder, those who lift and those who lean, those who contribute and those who only consume. How much better it is to give than to receive. Service in any form is comely and beautiful. To give encouragement, to impart sympathy, to show interest, to banish fear, to build self-confidence and awaken hope in the hearts of others. In short, to love them and to show it is to render the most precious service. Finally, my friends, what I would like to say is this. The main thing is to keep the main thing the main thing.
This concludes the audio learning program, First Things First. We hope this presentation has helped to deepen your understanding and commitment to effective life leadership. For information on additional products and services from Covey Leadership Center, please call 1-800-255-0777.